Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher. I'm also known as the Food Healer, and my guest today is John Roden. He's the program director of Toyota Together Green and the National Audubon Society. He's my guest. We're going to discuss what they do and how they do it. I'm really, really excited to talk to him and share this program with you guys, so let's get started. John, are you there?
I am here. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This is a huge interview for me. I'm really excited to talk to you guys. I'm so excited about this program and sharing it with our listeners. So I just want to jump in. Is that okay?
Absolutely. I'm excited too.
Yay. Thank you. So you're with the National Audubon Society. What do you guys do?
So the National Audubon Society is America's premier bird conservation organization, I would say, from an objective standpoint.
Okay.
And our mission really is to protect birds and their habitats around the country, really for the benefit of them, the wildlife they share those habitats with, and humans, because it's really important to us that we protect all habitat for birds. Humans benefit from that, and we can't separate ourselves from the habitats we share with them. So basically, where birds thrive, people do as well.
I love that. I love that. It's like, I know the Audubon Society just from, you know, the Audubon prints and things like that and how old
Correct.
You guys are. And I love the fact that you're including, like, you know, other species because everybody's involved, so.
Absolutely, yes.
So
and
how
we're all interconnected, so.
Exactly. So how long has the Society been around?
So it was officially formed in 1905, so 110 years ago was when it was incorporated as the National Audubon Society. And it around the turn of the 20th century is really when we think about the awakening of the conservation movement. And there was a lot of focus around birds back then. There was huge numbers of wading birds were killed and other birds for the millinery trade. And this started to raise the awareness of folks that this sort of indiscriminate slaughter was unsustainable, and people, and a lot of women, actually, I have to give a shout out that there was a lot of women at the forefront of this that really stood up and said, this can't continue, and organized and got the Audubon Society together to address this threat to species. And there's been, over these 110 years, there's been a number of successes stretching back to that time. The Migratory Bird Tree Act was passed in the 19-teens that protected migratory species across the Americas, working on the banning of DDT earlier in the middle part of the last century was something that the Audubon Society was heavily involved in. So there's been a number of conservation challenges that we've taken on as an organization and really had a really positive effect in addressing them.
I mean, the DDT issue alone is huge. Thank you guys for being the ones to really take that on.
Absolutely. Well, that was something certainly we were a strong part of that. There was Rachel Carson was the voice that got that, you know, the attention drawn to that.
Yep.
And there were certainly other organizations that were involved, but Audubon was right on the forefront of that.
That's very cool. Yeah. So what specifically do you do for the Audubon Society?
So I'm the director of a program called Toyota Together Green, which is an alliance between Toyota and the National Audubon Society that funds innovation grants for projects that address community-based conservation challenges across the country, as well as we confer conservation leadership fellowships on a number of folks every year as well. Both of these programs are geared toward increasing the diversity of conservation leadership around the country and engaging new and diverse audiences in conservation and just empowering community leaders to identify and address the conservation challenges that are facing their communities.
So the people that you're working with, are these just like regular people, or are these like PhD scientists? You know what I mean? Like, who's coming
to
you?
Yeah, it's actually, we have about the whole range from, we certainly have funded PhDs, but there's a number of folks that we've funded that I guess you would call the sort of normal folks.
Or the regular folks,
We strive to get a diversity of folks in the door that actually we support. And, you know, we take chances on folks that may not have as much experience as you know, other funders might expect or want in the people that they support. But we have a large part of what we try to do is to build the capacity of these folks to assume greater leadership and conservation in their communities. So at the beginning of the grant or fellowship period, we have a five-day training where we bring everybody together to receive capacity building on things like conservation planning, leadership, engaging diverse audiences, evaluation, fundraising. And so we certainly, you know, through the application process, we're looking for people that have an idea, at least, of how they might approach conservation challenges in their community. But we work very hard to nurture them and grow them so that they can do a more effective job.
That's awesome. That's really, really great. So, as you know, so many grants, you're like, here's your money, see you later, let us know what happened in a year, you know? So the fact that you guys are behind everyone and really helping them to succeed is just wonderful.
Exactly, yes. And we have, I mean, we have ongoing support during their grant or fellowship where we do monthly webinars. We try to keep them connected to each other and to us. So it's, so we aren't a typical funder. We're very hands-on as opposed to that model that you shared, you know, which is a viable model in certain, you know, it has its utility in certain areas. But we find ours to be very effective. And we've evaluated ours very strongly over the 7 years that we've been in existence and have a lot of data to show that our approach is effective at addressing, at achieving conservation impacts both locally and to scale, and also to continue to build the confidence and the ability of these folks to address challenges in their community. So we're really proud of the work that we've done.
I love that. I think that's amazing. I want to ask you some more questions about birds, but then I want to talk to you more about this whole program because, I mean, there's so much good things about it, but I got to ask you some bird questions because I'm desperate to know these answers. So,
okay, absolutely.
So, like, what issues are you guys seeing in birds lately? I mean, I know in my neighborhood, I live in Brooklyn, and normally we've got cardinals and blue jays and all kinds of things, and this year we had like six sparrows, and I saw nothing else.
Right.
So, why is this happening? Do you know?
Well, I don't know if I can address this the specific issues in your neighborhood, but certainly, so Audubon, one of the catalysts for the organization was back in 1900, Frank Chapman, who was a curator at the American Museum of Natural History, started the Christmas Bird Count, which was in response to, and I'm going to get to your question, answer your question.
Oh, it's all good. No, tell me, tell me.
Background. Was in response to the tradition at the time, which was on Christmas Day, people would go out and shoot birds. And they did it for sport. They did it not for food or anything like that. It was just a tradition. So he wanted to change that model. And what he did was start this Christmas bird count where people would go out on Christmas or around that. We do it the 2 weeks around Christmas and count all the birds that they can.
Okay.
And this, again, wasn't necessarily meant to be a scientific data collection method. It was meant to actually just change, you know, shift the way the focus of people to counting the birds. But what this has allowed us to do is over the 115 years, because it's been in existence since that time, this has yielded an incredibly rich data set for us to actually analyze and look at what's happening with bird populations.
Wow.
So this is it's what's called a citizen science project because we just get, you know, as many people involved as we can. And this happens across the world now. It started in New Jersey and New York City in Central Park back in 1900, and now it's a global effort.
Wow.
But what this allows, one of the things that's allowed Audubon scientists to do is to look at shifts in bird populations over time. And the sense, it's not a strict census, right? We don't know exactly how many birds are located where. But again, in 115 years, we can look at centers of population distribution, and we can see how those are shifting. And one of the analyses that National Audubon Society scientists did showed that the centers of bird populations were shifting northward over time, right? And that's, you know, that's most likely in response to climate change, right?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And is one of the few data sets that we have that actually can help illustrate what species responses are to climate change.
Wow.
So one of the things, when you ask, you know, what's going on with bird populations, the Audubon Society believes that climate change is one of the biggest threats mm-hmm. to bird populations globally, but also we have our, because of the data that we've been looking at, have the best understanding and thoughts about what's happening in the United States.
Yeah.
And we, there's, and all of this is available on our website, but there are 314 species that are either climate-threatened or endangered, meaning that
wow.
the effects of climate change could reduce their populations dramatically by the end of this century unless we take action.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, you know, there's the wider view of that, the ultimate view, and there's the proximate view as well, which is what people are seeing in their local communities,
yeah.
right? That they're seeing that there are changes that they're just noticing over time, that there's not as many birds present, et cetera. And that, so these bigger changes may be having those more micro effects that you're seeing in your local neighborhood as
totally.
Well.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, that that's a relation, too, because, I mean, with all the issues regarding honeybee die-off, and, I mean, mm-hmm. this summer, I did not see one monarch butterfly,
yeah.
which was, you know, I can't even go there. So I'm assuming this is also affecting the wild birds and the populations as well. I mean, I don't know if nicotinoids affect birds, but, you know, we know they affect bees and they affect butterflies, so.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that they have, you know, as the research is showing, that they have a very strong effect on insects, obviously, and that does have follow-on effects, obviously, to species that might prey on them,
yeah.
whether or not those nicotinoids have actually a direct effect by consumption of the or absorption by
mm-hmm.
birds is less clear to me, at least.
Yeah.
But all of those things that you meant, you know, monarchs, you know, the challenges that they're facing on so many fronts, and the loss of milkweed
yeah,
across
yeah.
the country and everything, all of those things, you know, connectivity of habitat is incredibly important to wildlife. And for species that move across the landscape in migratory ways, like butterflies, like birds, if you don't have that connectivity, you're really in trouble. So one of the things that obviously we're focused on is, as we work to address climate change, is part of it is creating climate strongholds. And so species that are migrating and moving have the ability to do that through the landscape, from wintering grounds to breeding grounds or whatever the movements that they're making, that they have that connectivity because it's so important to them.
And so, I mean, I know that the butterflies always go to like one specific spot a year. The monarchs do anyway to breed. Do different bird breeds do this as well?
Right, so the monarchs actually overwinter. They're not breeding when they're down in Mexico, right?
Oh, okay.
They just overwinter, and once they take off, they start breeding as they make their way back up north. And so birds in general are doing the same thing in winter when they go to if they're migratory, they go to Central South America, the islands in the Caribbean, and then they return to the breeding grounds up in, you know, the northern part of North America, and it depends where the species go. Some go to the boreal forest
mm-hmm.
up in Canada. Some go all the way up to the tundra. Some go into the
wow.
northeastern forests around New York. But, yeah, that's where they return to breed, and it's a, you know, evolutionarily speaking, it's an awesome strategy, right? Because
yeah.
you have great resources there. You have tons of bugs. You have lots of things to feed your offspring. When we humans have gotten in the way of, you know, creating these barriers
mm-hmm.
to that migratory pathway, or actually taking out the habitat that they need to breed, that obviously creates problems.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a break for just a minute and a half, maybe two, but I'm talking
okay.
to John Roden. We're talking about an amazing program that's Toyota Together Green, together with the National Audubon Society. So hang on, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back. If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
Hello out there. It's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
So we are back. I am talking to Dr. John Rowden. So sorry I have mispronounced your name. I was in the desert for 3 weeks. I'm just getting back. My brain's still kind of there. So, John, I apologize for that. I wish I had a better excuse for you.
Not a problem.
Thank you. So I want to talk about Toyota Together Green and what it is and how you guys got involved with them and everything you can tell me in the next 12 minutes, basically. So let's do it.
Sure. So the program started in 2008 was the first year that we funded projects, and it's actually a really interesting alliance between a large corporation, a car company, and a large environmental nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And what brought us together was that both of us have a desire to see change in the world, right?
Right.
Toyota has a very strong focus on environmental sustainability, have piloted the use of hybrid vehicles. They have a very strong environmental record in the United States. Their plants that they manufacture here have a very strong record of zero waste, doing everything they can to minimize their impact on the environment. Of course,
wow.
I understand it's a car,
yeah.
So we all understand that has its impacts. But in the current world, cars are an important part of the infrastructure,
yeah,
and so we have to deal with that reality. But they really wanted to support community-based conservation and in diversifying the leadership of conservation in this country, and that was something that's very important to us as an organization, which led to this alliance. And I have to say, Toyota's been a tremendous partner through these years. They have a very strong corporate culture of adaptive management or continuous improvement, which is something that we infuse the program with. So as I mentioned earlier, we evaluate the program very strongly, and we use the information we get from that to improve it as well. So the trainings that I mentioned that we have every year have changed over time because we get feedback that people need this or this would be more helpful or let's try it this way. And so that's an important part of our culture. To date, we've been funded to the tune of $25.4 million that we've invested in conservation, which is a tremendous investment and has had tremendous impacts across the country. So we have well over 400,000 volunteers and participants that our projects have engaged in conservation, direct conservation action. We've planted over 323,000 trees
My
and plants
Lord.
Around the country. So all of these things, and I I have a lot of other conservation metrics, but time may be limited for me to go into all of them. But there's just been it's been a great impact, and we've had, as I mentioned, the folks that we've funded, the conservation leaders, have really, one of the ways that we evaluate is talking to them about what the experience has been like, and it's really had a tremendous impact on their confidence and their ability to do their jobs.
That's so cool. That's so cool. You know, it's amazing with the numbers that you've got. I'm surprised that, like, Toyota Together Green isn't just, like, a common household word.
I think that same thing. I'd say it's very common in my house, but, there are other houses that I believe that don't know about it. So we are constantly striving to tell our story, so I appreciate this opportunity to do it.
I love the fact that you guys are doing this because, I mean, there's so many, there's so many nonprofits out there, and I talk to a lot of them for animal conservation and stuff, but it's usually quite specific, or it'll be, a dog rescue, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I love what you guys are doing because you're looking at this enormous picture and coming at it from all different angles. There's not just one solution. It's like there's a whole bunch. And so the odds are higher that you're going to be more successful if you do it this way, which I think is just fantastic.
Exactly. And you have to take risks. You know, we encourage people to think creatively about solutions. And not every attempt works. But what we try to do then is, okay, let's take a step back and see how we can continue to forge ahead. And that's something that's a trademark of the program as well. And I think that has proven over time to be really beneficial.
That's so cool. I'm so excited to have you on and share this. I can't even tell you. I'm so thrilled today. And so you guys give out a ton of grants. Like, what can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. So the innovation grants vary anywhere from $5,000 to $80,000 and are meant to achieve impact in improving habitat, improving water quality or quantity, or to address energy usage, reduction of energy usage.
Wow.
So within those broad areas, there also we seek to engage, as I've mentioned, new and diverse audiences in conservation, and to have partnerships. So we found, again, through evaluation, that partnerships are key to the success of projects. And interestingly, one of the things that we found is that projects that are the most effective at engaging new audiences are also more highly correlated with conservation success. So we walked into this wanting to, change the face of conservation in America, and for good reasons, I think. We know that the demographics in the country are changing, and we want to be reflective of that. But what we found through the process is that not only is, a good thing and beneficial in the big scheme of things, but it also makes your work more effective. And I think that's a fantastic outcome, and it's something that I think that we share more broadly with the conservation community, because everyone needs to understand how important that is.
That's really true. And do you have any young people that are getting grants, like teenagers or any classrooms, anything like that?
Well, so the grants that we give are early to mid-career professionals, and so the recipients of the grants are, we haven't done that yet. We're talking about that in the future iterations of the program, but definitely many of our the people that we funded work with those populations and work with youth. So we've had a lot of benefits that flow down to that population, but they haven't received funding directly from us.
Fair enough. And then is there a grant project that's one of your favorites? Like, can you tell us about some of the ones that you really love?
There are so many that I love. I was thinking that if I have time, I'd share a couple. One is we have a gentleman named Ken Elkins who works at the Audubon Center at Benton the River in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And he has developed a program called Bird Tales, which uses birds as a way to help patients that have dementia in nursing facilities to just improve their lives.
Cool.
So what he does is Audubon has stuffed birds. He'll take them in and work with the folks. And so many people, because birds are part of life, right? And so even folks with dementia, they see a bird and they can just connect with it, and it makes noise, and they really get drawn in. But the beauty of Ken's project is that what he's using this to do is to create more natural habitats around the the nursing facilities to attract birds.
Nice.
So using less pesticides, putting up nest boxes, putting up feeders, mm-hmm. doing things that actually will help attract wildlife, because that benefits wildlife, but it also benefits the people around those facilities,
totally.
And has follow-on effects to benefiting the folks that are in the facilities. And it's just a beautiful program. He started it in Connecticut. He's expanded it to Colorado and Texas.
Wow.
And he has materials that that he's produced that are available, and he's continuing to use this. It's really been a great program.
What a great idea.
Yeah, it's really, so that's one that I love. We funded another project that is out in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Institute for Applied Ecology partnering with the Department of Corrections in Oregon and the Oregon Zoo and mm-hmm. the Audubon Society of Corvallis. And what they did is work at a women's correctional facility called the Coffee Creek Institutional Facility, and worked with the inmates there to produce plants for the Oregon silver spot butterfly, which is a federally listed butterfly species.
Cool.
And so what these inmates did was they would grow. So there's the Oregon silver spot butterfly. Its entire life cycle relies on this plant, this violet that grows along the coast of Oregon.
Mm.
So they grow the plants at the jail, at the prison. They then give the leaves to the zoo, the Oregon Zoo in Portland, that actually then feeds the caterpillars. When they metamorphose into adults, then they are also growing plants that they are planting out on the coast, and then the adults are then translocated out to the coast, and then that habitat that's been restored is then replenished with wildlife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a great full life cycle approach to how we would actually try to restore this population and its habitat. And again, it's just involving folks that haven't ever been part of the conversation around conservation,
yeah.
but really get a tremendous amount out of it and are really benefiting conservation in the process.
And it's just so cool that you're just using all these people, and so they're all getting educated, and then they're talking
Absolutely.
To people about it, and you know, and so on and so on.
Absolutely. And giving them skills, too, right?
Yeah.
Because many of these, and I visited that project, the women, when they get out of jail, they need to have something to do. And this
True.
Is part of that whole process of giving them skills and helping them see their life beyond the walls of the prison.
Totally. And, I mean, yeah. for women as well, you know, it brings in the nurturing and all of that as well. So I would think that it sounds just like, it's so brilliant, but on the other hand, it sounds like this total, like, no-brainer idea, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's
right.
it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I love that you guys are doing stuff like that. You know, it's they're so unusual.
Right. And I think that, you know, we call our granting program Innovation Grants, and we really do strive to support projects that are creative and again take risks. And we I would say that very few of the projects, when we get the proposal to what comes out at the very end of it, it's a smooth linear relationship. You know, there's all sorts of, you know, jigs and jags and stuff, but
yeah.
people are staunch and they really continue to try, and we support them in that, and we've had tremendous success.
I love it. So what are some things that my listeners can do to help you guys out?
Sure. Well, I think that there's, you know, certainly Audubon.org, the Audubon website, has a variety of ways that people can get involved. We have 463 chapters around the country. We have 43 nature centers and sanctuaries. And you can go to Audubon.org and click on Audubon Near You, which mm-hmm. will tell you where an Audubon facility or location is near you. There's lots of ways that you can get involved doing habitat restoration work, volunteering for that, getting involved in citizen science like the Christmas Bird Count I've mentioned. You
mm-hmm.
don't need specific skills to do that necessarily. So there's lots of ways you can get involved that way. You can advocate. Certainly we need people to step up and add their voice to
mm-hmm.
our desires and our need to change the conversation about climate change.
Yeah,
that's
no kidding,
because
huh?
that's such a threat. So that we can all use the assistance with that. And then you can make changes in your own habitats. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have yards or if you have green spaces in your community, there's lots of ways to make them more friendly to birds, planting native species. There's a lot of problems, and in New York, there's big problems with building collisions during migration.
Mm.
I don't know if you, during the Tribute in Light that happens on September 11th.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
The beams of light, which are, I was in New York on September 11th. It's a very powerful reminder of what happened that night. But the problem is it happens during migration, and birds use light as a cue when they migrate, mm-hmm. including the moon and the stars. And so when there's a massive amount of light that's shot into the sky during migration, it can be very confusing for them. And in the most recent Tribute in Light, just a couple weeks ago, there's a partnership between Audubon and the Municipal Arts Society the 9/11 Memorial that runs that tribute to shut off the lights if it's problematic for birds. And that the night of September 11th, the memorial was shut off 8 times to allow birds to clear out. Because once the lights are extinguished, they regroup and sort of proceed on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, that's just an example writ large, but turning off lights is important during migration, especially on tall buildings,
mm-hmm.
Because it's just very distracting to birds. And again, there's much of this stuff is on the Audubon website, so there's lots of ways that people can look at that to either get involved themselves or to raise their voices. Once they understand more about what the threats are to birds, they're just more informed and they can share those views.
Totally.
It's
and
important.
And the website's beautiful. Like, if you haven't been to the website, you need to check
it
out. It's spectacular. Yeah. And, I mean, hearing that about 9/11, I'm really happy to hear that, because I saw an article, I guess it was last year, after the tribute, and it was talking about birds getting trapped in the lights.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, well, what can you do? You know, because everyone's like, no, it's the lights. But if people are aware of this and they're being shut off for short periods of time, I think it would be a lot more empathy and understanding of why this is happening and being like, okay, this is a good thing that they're off for a couple seconds. This isn't like some travesty and, you know, we're not harming or marring the memories of what happened or anything like that. You know, it's more about like letting these animals do what they were doing 1,000 years ago.
Exactly. Well, and I think that, you know, that was, 9/11 obviously was an enormous tragedy, but in honoring the lives that were lost, I don't think that we should sacrifice any other lives,
no.
Be they birds or whatever, right?
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. We are running out of time. I'm so bummed out. I could talk to you for 2 hours.
I'd be up for that.
We're going to have to do a part two sometime, and I want to.
Okay.
I would love to actually, and find out, you know, what are the new things that you guys are working on and innovations and stuff like that. And just for people that want to know more about the Toyota Together Green, I'm assuming that's on the Audubon site, but is there somewhere they should look?
So we actually have a separate website for Together Green, and it's for Toyota Together Green, and it actually is just called togethergreen.org.
Okay.
So they can visit that website.
This sounds perfect. Doctor, I appreciate your time. I appreciate what you guys do. Please thank everybody for what they're doing. I'm so honored to have shared this information with my listeners. And like I said before, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're an incredibly busy man. So thanks for taking a half hour and sharing it with us and teaching us some stuff.
Not a problem. It's totally been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I will be back next week with a new episode. Until then, have a great time. And everybody, just take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.